He will mercilessly ask you hard questions, and you may feel uneasy while trying to answer. However, just do your best, since the questions are the right ones which you must, in any case, answer to be successful. That's how my next guest has been described by a startup founder. You're about to hear a conversation with Risto Rautakorpi from Gorilla Capital. This video is a part of a series, Startup Scoring. We are producing it with Liquido.vc, who support startups and startup founders on their journey from the beginning to the exit. Jussi Muurikainen from Liquido will join me in studio as a co-host. Enjoy.
Yes, yes, yes. Täällä ollaan. Here we are. So, Kallimäki podcast is live, and in the studio with me is Jussi Muurikainen from Liquido VC. And online we have Risto Rautakorpi from Gorilla Capital. How are you doing, Risto?
Very well, thank you.
Jussi, can you tell a couple words to our audience about yourself? Let's keep it all very short. We have maybe 25 minutes or so. So this is going to be a short and sweet beginning podcast for today on startup scoring.
Yeah, I've been in startups for 17 years and nowadays helping startups and startup founders as working as a sort of a startup architect in the companies.
And Risto, can you give a little heads up to our audience of Kallimäki podcast? They're mostly LinkedIn Live people there who are wondering, what are we talking about here on Startup Scoring, and what's your position on Gorilla Capital, and what's your expertise?
Well, I'm one of the founders of Gorilla Capital. I have been full-time in the startup world for the past 15 plus years, and under the Gorilla name we have now worked for 12, 13 years. We initially started as an accelerator and then morphed into an investor, and now we are on our third fund. In total, we have invested in over 100 companies so far, have had a few exits already, and I know enough to understand how little I know.
That's a great way to put it. One thing I noticed when looking at your website of Gorilla Capital is that a lot of your business partners say, these founders of companies say that you have a way of asking brutally honest questions. So could you give us some examples of what might be a brutally honest question to a founder that really goes under their skin maybe, but may reveal something great about a business?
Well, hard to give an example now out of the blue because it's always very context dependent, but my goal is always to understand, and I don't give up until I do. Or then I have to conclude that they just don't have the answers. And I guess that's where that comment is coming from, that I expect them to know what they talk about. And I don't let them off the hook easily.
And where would you say that you've got this experience from over your career? Where have you learned most the skills that you need now in Gorilla Capital?
It's a combination of many things. It's personal experience, but it's an endless hunger for learning, to learn from others. So I have two academic degrees on the background, but I think I have at least an additional one from this startup stuff. I've read many books, I've listened to many podcasts and read articles because I really want to understand. And I want to learn from the people who know more than I do. So what I have today is kind of the combination of that, decades of own experience, plus open eyes and ears to learn from those who know more.
I have actually a strong recommendation for us that are getting this gray hair, actually to work with startups, because that's one of the ways you can always update your system. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's a way to kind of stay young, because start by definition, I try to find answers to the questions where no existing answers, where no answers exist. And they are always in the front line, taking advantage of the newest stuff. So in that way, you stay up to date.
What's the market right now in terms of deal flow, for example? Does it feel like there is an increased or decreased deal flow right now? What's the general atmosphere on startup funding right now?
Well, the market certainly is tough for anyone to raise funds, whether it's raising funds for a VC fund like ourselves. We've been fundraising for over a year now, so speak from that experience. But it also seems to be extremely tough for the startups. We've never seen before a situation we have now seen. There were actually two companies in Sweden to whom we committed. We are often the first to commit, so we are used to having to wait for the rest of the round to come together. But now, after 6 months, the founders still were not able to raise the rest of the round, and they had to give up. They filed for bankruptcy. So money is clearly extremely tight. It's a good time to be an investor, so our deal flow is better than ever, both quality and quantity. It's a sum of many things. Probably our own experience and reputation and the brand recognition, all that contributes to that. But also the market is hard, and there are not many parties who are actively investing, and we are one of those. So that certainly helped us to get the attention.
Yes, and I can agree on that. 17 years in startups and 50 plus rounds. And now it seems that, of course, the best companies always get the funding. I still remain that. But then it takes more time and effort to get the rounds done. So there is no easy money at the moment at the market. But maybe we should go to, because Risto and I had a good pre-discussion about the scoring itself. Shortly about the Camel strategy, I would like to ask describe it for the audience, because you are famous of that wording.
Well, the camel metaphor, like many other great things we cherish, were not originally invented by ourselves. We picked it from an Harvard Business School, Harvard Business Review article, which was titled about, hey, founders, you should build camel companies, not unicorns. And we read it and we thought, that, holy shit, this describes the audience we work with. And from there, we kind of picked up the name. And now it has become a bit of a fashion. Many others have started to use that as well. But for us, it's been the bread and butter long before it had a name. Because it's not the fashion, it's timeless. Because the core of that is to build sustainable real business rather than focus on raising the next round. And when you have this approach, you try to raise as little as possible. You try to manage with as little external capital as possible. And from there follows the whole strategy, which is very frugal, very capital efficient, very cost conscious, kind of accepts the realities rather than tries to fight the trends and accept double or nothing type of odds. So this is for rational risk takers, not those more of a gambler type, because this double or nothing, it's brutal. There can be only be often one winner and everybody else tried equally hard but didn't make it. In the camel world, you have better control of your own destiny.
Yes, I would say that it's also about, we have been talking about PowerPoint companies.
Yeah.
So this is not about those. And I think that they have a pretty hard times at the moment to build the case. So more like you try to find the companies that do sales, are really like market oriented, try to find the product market fit even before getting any funding and so on, instead of just building good decks, slide decks for the investors.
Yeah, I just watched an interview of Jeff Bezos, and he really emphasized that PowerPoint is a sales tool. If you have a meeting, an internal meeting in a company, you should actually do a memo. That's really hard to write. You need to define a lot of things. But it's not a sales tool. You really get to solve the problem better. So I see some similarities in this one here. So the camel strategy, this metaphor comes from camel being a very frugal animal, able to outlive the harsh elements of the desert with little water?
Well, yeah, the key thing with camels is that they always get there. Rain or shine, they get there. And because they never know how long trip they have to make to get to the next oasis, they have to be very economical with all the resources, with the energy and water and whatever, to make sure that whatever they happen to have is enough to get them there. And they don't try to fight the environment. If there's a sandstorm, okay, they wait. They get into this shelter position and just wait for the storm to pass, and then they continue. But what is a misconception that the camels are slow? Camels don't waste energy. So if they are not in a hurry, there's no need to rush. But if need be, they can go really fast. They are actually faster than horses. And there are camel races in the Middle East. Actually, lots of betting industry around that as well. But yeah, they only run fast if it's needed, because otherwise it results in an unnecessary waste.
You have been doing so a long time, startups. I would like to ask, like, the core elements, that how do you find those camels? How do you describe which are the most relevant scoring points that you want to get, like 10 out of 10 or something? Or how do you evaluate the companies based on all of your experience? Because it's, I know it from my own experience, that it's constant learning process. it's not something that you can learn in school.
Yeah. Well, our screening actually happens in two phases. The initial, what we call the raw filtering, is based on structural elements. And in there, we look at the relatively easily visible elements to establish whether it is a potential fit with our strategy at all or not. So it's not about, is the case good or bad? It's just a question of, would it be a fit for us? And over 80% of the incoming deal flow is rejected at that stage because it's just not compatible with what we are looking for. If it goes further than that, then we start digging deeper into whether it's good enough versus the criteria we look at. And actually on that point, already for years, if I had to summarize the secret of startup success in one sentence, I've quoted Steve Blank. This is a sentence I have stolen from one of his books. The difference between winning startups and those who lose is that the winners understand why customers buy. The losers never do. And that skill is the single most indicator or predictor of the eventual success. So we dig deep into that. So do the founding team or the founder himself, him or herself, have that ability and passion to understand the customer problem and understand what makes the customer buy? If the founders have that, the rest is basically just work. Yes, you can mess things up in a million ways, and I'm not trying to over-trivialize. There are challenges on the rest of the journey as well. But that is the single most important element. If you have that, the rest can be done. But if you don't have that, nothing will help you.
I'm giving an example of our own deal flow. There was a company that we were having this scoring process and discussions, and then we asked the question that, who are your customers? And the answer was B2B. And then I was, okay, but how would you describe better the segments that you will serve? They're companies. The companies are our customers. So if you are a startup founder and you want to get funding, I would say that you really need to know who is your customer and to understand if they have a need or not. So you cannot have that need in your mind or in your seller when you're building something, but you have to discuss with the customers. You have to understand the exact segments that you're going to serve.
Exactly. Risto, what would be some interesting target demographics or target users that the startup has identified correctly? Jussi just gave a sort of bad example of a too vague answer. So what have you come across that would be like a really accurate?
Well, hard to remember an exact real example, but the maturity of the founders' thinking and their understanding of the business can be seen from how narrowly they can define their ICP, the ideal customer profile. The more narrow, the better. And often the starting point, it always is very, very broad, and then step by step you narrow it down. And in a way, I've illustrated the objective for the founders I speak with, and this might be part of the brutally honest questions, is that when you find 6 ICP customers in Finland, then you have narrowed it down close enough. And if 4 or 5 of them buy, then you nailed the ICP and kind of your target. That's then the core from which you can start to expand. Because you understand the core, then you can kind of raise your eyes a bit and you start seeing things differently. But when you try to address too broad of an audience, you don't see the detail, you don't understand what makes them tick, and then you just spread yourself too thin and you will never get the real product market fit. But when you can narrow it down so narrow that there's no way to go further, that's the goal.
Yes, and this, so yeah, I would really underline the same thinking. And then if you find that, then you can scale also globally, because then you know the exact customer profile that you want to search from abroad. And this is many times that the founders think that they have to bring the investors like really, really big numbers and market potential numbers and figures. And that's not the point.
Everybody wants this.
This is for everyone.
Product, not customer. Let's talk about our product.
Mm, yeah. Then some kind of like red flags from your scoring point of view, that if you have selected them to go forward from the first phase of scoring, what are the red flags that you usually try to avoid in the companies?
Complacency, complacent attitude, lack of humility, because this is a learning game. So the early stage, and we are an early stage investor, later stage might be a bit different, but in the early stage, it's all about learning, understanding who is your customer, getting to the product market fit, all that. You need to be humble to be able to learn. So a cocky attitude is a really big red flag for us. But then from the structural perspective, if it's not capital efficient, then it is just ruled out from our perspective. We just don't invest in those. The red flags basically are the mirror images of the pro filtering criteria, the 8 ones that are visible on our website. Any of those could potentially create a red flag. So if there's I'll give you an example. If someone approaches us and says that, hey, I have made an invention, I have a patent, can I show you a demo? I tell them, no thanks, this was enough, because you already gave me 3 wrong answers. We don't invest in products. We are not the target customers, so seeing a demo is kind of meaningless, because we might have an opinion, but it's useless, because we are not their customer. So the focus needs to be on the business, not product or the tech.
Very, very good answer. Would you say that it's important for a new startup to have a business where it's hard for others to enter? Or are you okay with funding a startup which basically everybody could enter that failed? How do you view barriers to entry from the funder's view?
Well, you need to have a competitive advantage of some kind. Otherwise, you will be just one of many, and then how can you win any business? So you need to have an edge somewhere. But you don't need to be the only one for everyone. It goes back to identify the narrow ICP niche. So you might be the best solution for the 10 customers you have identified there are. And for them, you are the best cause of something. But then for the next 10 or the other 100, you're not the best, because their needs are slightly different. So yes, you must have a competitive advantage of some kind. Otherwise, you can't win customers. But how you define the market is a big part of how you view the competition.
How about then one of the things the founders many times that when they try to evaluate the best partners to support them in the funding and building of the companies, could you describe the stage in which you are mostly operating, like, because many times they are wondering if they have to have revenue or not. What is the sort of?
Well, we are an early stage investor. In a way, you could think of us as an industrial scale angel investor, super angel investor. So we operate in the part of the food chain where the typical players are angel investors. So pre-product market fit, but kind of the minimum threshold for us is that you need to have a sellable product and you must have experience from at least trying to sell it. You are not required to have any real business necessarily yet. Yeah, good if you have, all the better. But the starting point needs to be that you have a sellable product and you have experience from real life selling, and proof of your ability to understand the customers. And where we probably have some special value to add is in the journey of getting to the first skeleton of a product market fit to the real one, which is the cornerstone of real business. Because it's not an art, it's a science. You can do that very methodically in a cost-conscious fashion. And we know a fair bit about that. And that's where we give guidance to our portfolio companies.
I have one more question at least left. For instance, yesterday we went through our deal flow, and then we had one company that went through the scoring process with pretty high numbers from that, like, a technical point of view of scoring. But then based on the intuition and sort of things that you cannot sometimes describe, we didn't go through with that company. And Risto, this is my question. What is the role of intuition in the end?
It's big. It's very big, because intuition is actually fuzzy logic. It's when there are too many data points for you to analyze in a structural fashion, you apply kind of pattern recognition, and that's where intuition comes into play. So it's kind of subconscious recognition of something you've seen before, and what we have seen in our experience is that intuition predicts. Because there have been cases where the intuition said something, but we couldn't find the real evidence to support it, so we did different against the intuition. Later on, we found out why the intuition was right, and we have learned to listen to the intuition, because it sees things that the eye and the brains doesn't yet recognize.
Yes, I've been having this example of mushrooming, because I'm a big lover of mushrooming, and it's all about, like, recognizing from the forest, for instance, what is the forest type, what is the actual place in the forest, what is sort of things needed for there to be able to find the exact mushroom. And I think that's a bit same with the startups, that you sort of cannot read from the books of the shape of the mushrooms, and you don't find the mushrooms with the book. But when you learn sort of the environment and know the places where you see those exact things that you want to find from, then you find the best ones.
Well, yeah, you learn to notice the proxies and the kind of the indicators, which don't directly say anything, but you learn from experience when there's this and this, typically is an indicator of something. And then you don't need to analyze the whole thing to have a pretty good idea. And that's where intuition certainly helps.
I think we are finished with Risto. We could discuss about this for hours, but thanks a lot.
We'd love to have you longer, Risto, but maybe we'll book you another time if you're interested in joining us here on LinkedIn Live. So thank you, Risto, a lot from these wise thoughts. And we wish for everybody who believes their company is a camel to find Risto, find Gorilla Capital, and get ready for those brutally honest and wise questions. Kiitos, Risto.
Okay. stage.